Next Monday marks 10 years since the Columbine school shooting, the one that riveted America in its attention, the one that left 13 people dead and scores more wounded, both physically and mentally, by that incident. Dave Cullen was one of the first reporters at Columbine High School just outside of Denver on April 20th, 1999. He reported on the story that day and in the days afterwards and has spent most of the last decade digging further into the story, talking with people who were there, doing hundreds of interviews, reading the journals of the two killers, reading the police reports, all to compile what in my reading is the definitive book on Columbine, simply entitled Columbine. Dave Cullen joins me now here on 84 WHAS. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Congratulations on your work here. Take me back to that day. Where were you when you heard the report, and what did you see when you first got to Columbine High School?
I was in my living room of my apartment when I first heard it. I just had, by chance, turned on TV for lunch right about the time that it first hit television, and so I just left my editor a message and got out of my car and got out there. And the first thing that I saw, which was about 1 o'clock, about an hour and a half into it, I got to a place called the Columbine Library nearby, where there were mostly parents in panic. There were two different rendezvous points set up, and that was originally the primary one the parents were sent to, but the kids mostly went to the other one. And so there were a lot more parents than kids, and they were terrified, and there were some kids coming in with stories, and it was just unbelievable.
There were lots of stories going around that day and in the succeeding days, many of which became national myths, if
right.
you will. They became generally accepted wisdom. And we're going to get into some of these, but first I want to talk a little bit about the work that you've done in putting this story together, because you got what I think anybody would have to say was extraordinary access to a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
You got inside the sheriff's department, you got inside the Harris and Klebold families and got to see a lot of these things. Tell me what you learned about these two teenage boys, 17 and 18 years old, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, the Columbine killers.
Okay, well, I really did. With the Harris and Klebold families, though, with those two, I didn't get directly to them. They haven't talked to anyone in the press, with one exception. The Klebolds talked to David Brooks at one point 5 years ago. But I talked to some of the people close to them, particularly the Klebolds. And then there were nearly 1,000 pages of documents released, written by the killers, and as well as some videos. And what I found about them was Eric was not that shocking. It was sort of terrifying, but not that big of a surprise. Eric Harris was a psychopath, which in the clinical definition of that term, not sort of the Hollywood version, is someone who just doesn't have a conscience. You know, killing human beings was sort of like stamping out ants on the sidewalk. It just didn't matter to him. And psychopaths are typically not violent. They rarely are. But when you put that together with a sadistic streak, you get a really dangerous person. Frequently, those people turn out to be psycho killers. But in some cases, like Eric, they're spree killers or mass murderers of a different kind. So that was Eric. And, you know, reading his journal, it was hate, hate, hate all the way through. And from the first page where he opens with, "I hate the effing world," of course, he spelled it out. To the end, it's Eric wanted to kill people. But Dylan was the revelation. Dylan was completely different than I expected. The word love is the most common word in his journal. And his journal lasted for 2 years before he died. And it's bleak in many, many places, and there's anger in there, too. But it sure doesn't look like a killer. He's a young boy, starting out at the age of 15 when he's writing this thing, trying desperately to love, talking about the everlasting conflict, he says, constantly between good and evil, and thinking he's going to come out in good. But gradually, over 2 years, he's drawn into Eric's circle, and that journal looks nothing like the journal of a killer, but he ends up being a killer.
So Harris was the mastermind, a guy who wanted to leave a lasting impression on the world, right?
Definitely, yes.
and that was going to be an impression of death spread around as much as he possibly could. I mean, in reading your book, I'm surprised how massively they planned the details of this thing.
Oh, God. I planned them out in details. You know, one of the other biggest myths about Columbine is that it was intended primarily as a school shooting, when in fact it was intended as a bombing. And they brought two big bombs into the cafeteria, which would have killed everyone in there instantly, which was more than 500 people, and it would have been far worse than Oklahoma City. But the bombs are set to go off at 11:17, which was the time there would be the maximum number of people in the school in any one place in any time. And Eric knew that because he had sat down and watched minute by minute as the different class bells rang, how many people were in the cafeteria, and as all the people rushed in, you know, picture the start of a lunch, go back to high school, and you know, anytime the passing periods where there's just massive people in the hallways. This is a big school of about 2,000 kids. And, you know, everybody piles into the cafeteria. But meanwhile, people start leaving because they're going out to Wendy's or Subway's, the upperclassmen, and they're just using it as a rendezvous point. So people are flowing in and flowing out. And he watched the numbers and logged them to know exactly minute by minute how many people were there, and then 11:17 is the moment it would peak, and that's when he set his bombs to go off.
Not only did they put bombs in the school, but they even planted bombs in their cars because they had the foresight to know that the media would come, and they wanted to blow up some of them, too.
Exactly. And that's a standard IR tactic. They got all their tactics really from terrorists. And this was the first attack employing terrorist tactics in the U.S. for a non-terrorist event, for a non-political event, just for their own aggrandizement. But yes, they had the attack was supposed to go down in three acts, first with the big bombs blowing off, then act two was them out in the parking lot in specific places parked by their cars to triangulate two of the three main exits of the school to mow down the survivors as they came out. And then 45 minutes into it, their cars were supposed to bomb, which would have been very close to the triage points where ambulances were loading severely injured people in, and TV cameras would have been there, and that would have been seen on TV. And that's the IRA did that all the time so that the British soldiers and medical workers would be there, and it would be filmed, and there would be a second, you know, more horrifying event. And, yeah, they plan the same thing.
The book is called Columbine. It is the definitive history of that landmark event in recent American history. Dave Cullen is the author. When we come back, I'll ask him about the trench coat mafia, the bullies, the goth kids, and all the other myths that surrounded Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold, and the rest of Columbine High School on that April day a decade ago. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Francine Show on 84 WHAS. 52 degrees down in Louisville. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for Francine, and talking with Dave Cullen, the reporter who has put together a definitive history of a landmark in recent American history, the shootings at Columbine High School just outside of Denver. The book is simply called Columbine. It was the deadliest high school shooting in U.S. history. Dave was there covering it that day, and now a week away from the 10th anniversary, we're talking about his book. And let's get into some of the myths about these killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, who left 13 corpses in their wake. Let me ask you about some of these myths, and you tell me true or not. I remember a three-word phrase that was mentioned a lot in the media in that week, and that was trench coat mafia, that Harris and Klebold were supposedly part of a group at that school who wore long duster kind of jackets and took on the name the trench coat mafia. What's the deal?
That's false, primarily. They were perhaps fringe members of the Trenchcoat Mafia at most, which didn't really exist anymore by the school year that we were talking about, and it had nothing to do with it. Nobody else was associated with it, with the murders. Yeah, it was complete myth. And let me just pause on that one. I'll give you some quicker answers for the other ones, but on that one I think it's really important because that was the first thing that we learned about these kids. Eric and Dylan supposedly learned about it, and I think it really cast them as freaks and something totally different than us, and gave us a measure of safety. Let us feel like, well, we don't have any trench coat mafia here. But that's what was really completely wrong, and allowed us to distance ourselves from Columbine. When in fact, Dylan, in particular, was just an average American kid who could have been in any high school in America.
he just got twisted by this guy, Eric Harris. You know, in reading the book, I see such parallels with the Truman Capote work In Cold Blood, which I hope you'll take as a compliment.
Thank you.
Because Capote's work was about Richard Hickok and Perry Smith, and, you know, in that case, Hickok was the bolder, stronger personality, and Perry Smith kind of went along for the ride. And in reading your book, Columbine, I see a similar relationship between Harris and Klebold.
Yeah, there really is. And, you know, there's psychologists call it a dyad, D-Y-A-D, where you get two people together and do these kinds of things. Obviously, there's Bonnie and Clyde, there's Leopold and Loeb, and the two shootings outside of District of Columbia in Baltimore about 10 years ago. Now, those people are the exception. Most mass murderers work alone. But when they do work together, there tends to be this particular dyad where, or dynamic where there is a dominant person and someone else who obviously is guilty as well. Dylan Klebold, you know, murdered people in cold blood. But he probably never would have organized it himself. He's the type of person who was drawn into something. So you've got two completely different personalities. And that's, you know, you've touched on perhaps the most important thing about Columbine. And the first thing that I often tell audiences is they want to know why they did it. And there's no they here. There's an Eric Harris here and a Dylan Klebold, completely different people, opposite personalities, who really went about it for very different reasons, of their each of their own.
All right, let me go back to the Trenchcoat Mafia and other rumors that were around there. We also heard that these two boys had been bullied in school by jocks, and they purposely had gone there that morning targeting jocks in the school.
Right, another myth. And the jocks, the bullying thing is slightly complicated because there definitely was some bullying at Columbine High School, and that's been well documented. I don't know many American high schools where you can find out where there aren't kids bullying each other. You know, they don't do it right in front of the teachers. They're not fools about it. They know, you know, when I was in gym class, there's, you know, one guy with about, I don't know, we had probably 100 kids in our gym class. The minute his back is turned, you know, you can smack somebody, you can do whatever you want. And the, you know, teacher turns around and, you know, you come back to attention or whatever. So kids are very smart, and they know how to do it, and that goes everywhere. I haven't seen any evidence that there was, you know, particularly excessive bullying. I mean, any bullying is too much, but I didn't get any evidence that there was more at Columbine High School than the average high school, and particularly with these two kids. And in particular, in their 1,000 pages of writing, they're not complaining about that word. That never comes up. You know, they don't see it as a cause.
There were rumors inside the high school that Harris and Klebold were gay, and in fact some evangelicals afterwards, and we'll get to that in just a minute, another story about evangelicals, but there were some who claimed that this was gay rage. Were they?
Right. No, there was nothing. You know, even in their most private journals where Dylan confessed to having a foot fetish, and actually, you know, he was constantly talking to God and trying to improve himself and going on a spiritual quest. He actually called it that. And there were a couple times where he promised to stop masturbating. He gets very, very personal. Never any kind of hint of anything remotely like that. You know, those kinds of rumors really, say more about the person, making the rumor, and the sad fact that, you know, being gay or saying a kid is a fag or a gay is still probably the worst epithet you could throw against a teenager, which is sad, says more about, you know, some of the rest of us than it does about these two kids.
I agree. We're debunking some of the myths and getting the true story of Columbine from the man who wrote the book, literally. It's called Columbine. He's Dave Cullen, and we're back with more in a moment here on the Francine Show with Paul Harris on 84 WHAS. Francine has the week off, but she'll be back Friday to do Radio Wand Ads in the 10 a.m. hour. If you're looking for people to come work for you, that's where you get a chance to advertise it for free. And so far, she's put dozens of people in Kentuckiana back to work. Friday mornings at 10, Radio Wand Ads exclusively here on the Francine Show on 84 WHAS. Dave Cullen has written the definitive book about the deadliest high school shooting in U.S. history. The book is simply entitled Columbine. We are 1 week away from the 10th anniversary of that school shooting. And Dave, we've talked about some of the rumors that were going around. Let's talk about some of the people who might deserve some of the blame. And let's start with the Sheriff's Department, which held back the SWAT team that day because they thought Harris and Klebold were still alive for hours and hours with hostages inside, long after they were really dead, right?
Yes, well, they held the first hostage team back for about an hour. And, you know, that's really a tough call. The cops made some big mistakes, and one of the mistakes they made that day, particularly the command team, is they probably should have set the SWAT team in there. But that's a little bit of a conflicted story, too, because at that time, that really was the protocol. They went by the book. And, you know, there were quite a few cops out there who felt the commander should have thrown away the book and realized, you know, use common sense and do something different here. But that was the protocol at the time, which was to create a perimeter, surround the school, don't let people out who are planning typically to take hostages, and that's not what was going on there. But since then, the protocol has changed, and it's something called the active shooter protocol, which has been adopted throughout the country, where now it is the standard procedure and the training to charge in and to neutralize the shooter. And that has been implemented. That's one of the good things that come out of Columbine at Virginia Tech. It probably saved a lot of lives and at quite a few other school shootings.
Dave, would armed security guards in the school have made a difference?
Well, they did have one. They had one, they called him the school resource officer, who was outside eating lunch near the smoking area watching those kids, and was called and came over, and he exchanged some fire with Eric Harris. But, you know, he was heavily outgunned. He had his little pistol, and these people had automatic weapons. So, you know, it may have helped if there were more, but I think they still would have been outgunned.
What about the parents of Harris and Klebold? We hear stories about them knowing that their kids were down in the basement but not knowing what they were doing while the boys were supposedly building the pipe bombs that they would use at Columbine that day. How much blame do we put on them?
Well, you know, I really leave that for the reader, but I will tell you that nearly everyone who has read the book has come away saying they had a very different view of the parents. And oddly enough, that they have told me that it's the first time they really thought about it from the parents' point of view and put themselves in their shoes and thought, well, if I, you know, say for Dylan, if I had a kid who was kind of morose and depressed and I was, you know, working with him and trying to help him, but he had some anger issues that he had since he was a boy, and he was, you know, kind of depressed as a teenager. Well, you know, that sounds like a typical American teenage boy. And, you know, you're working with him, but do you really think, gosh, my 16-year-old's depressed. I wonder if he's planning mass murder.
Hmm. But in Eric's case, we had a kid who was a psychopath.
Eric, yes.
Did his parents have any indication of that? Did they try to do something about it?
Well, they didn't realize a psychopath, but I don't think that almost any parent in America really knows what a psychopath is. And if they have the idea from the movies, it's completely wrong. If you think of, say, you know, the most famous psychopath we know is Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs. And that's what a psychopath looks on the inside, a sadistic psychopath, by the way, which is rare when you put the two things together, sadistic and psychopath. But we do have some of those people. And Eric Harris was very, very similar to Hannibal Lecter inside. But a psychopath is never going to tell you that he wants to eat your liver. It's quite the opposite. I mean, if you want to picture a psychopath and the way he appears to you and to me, think of Hugh Grant. Charming is the most common characteristic description of a psychopath. They seem like really nice guys. Their entire life is an act. So when you've got one in your house, when he's your kid, Eric Harris was incredibly adept at fooling his parents. He fooled his parents, his friends, his teachers, the counselors in the diversion program, two of them who let him out earlier, said he was a wonderful young man, the judge who sentenced him, the school administrators, his own friends. He fooled every single person in his life.
Well, he didn't fool everybody. Didn't parents of some of the other kids complain to the police about him, and that's how he ended up in the system in the first place?
Right. There was one set of parents. Well, he ended up in the system because they got caught breaking into a van. They got caught red-handed stealing material. They grabbed a bunch of electronic equipment and put it in their car and then drove off to a state park at night and were alone in the parking lot. They could be really kind of dumb about these things. We're going through the loot with the lights on and a state trooper driving by. you know, saw just one lone car lit up and came up and said, hey, where'd you get all that equipment? So they didn't get caught that way. They did, there was one neighborhood lady, Judy Brown, and who kept reporting them, who kept reporting Eric, and that should have left tip the cops off. But, you know, there's one thing, you know, I overstated it slightly a moment ago when I said Eric Harris fooled everyone. And this is almost universal with psychopaths. They fool almost everyone, and they fool everyone who matters to them. If someone is a psychopath in your life and they're not fooling you, what that generally means is they don't care about you. They know they can get away with you. You don't matter. And they really enjoy, they're sort of like a poker player who really enjoys, you know, showing two of his cards and still beating you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Eric Harris, and that's a psychopath. And Judy Brown was his shown cards. We're like, yeah, just watch me. You know, and no one's going to believe you, and I'm going to get away with it, and then I'm really going to be laughing.
Dave, since Columbine, we've had students hauled into the principal's office for essays that they've written in English classes and social studies classes that have been filled with all sorts of violent images. Some kids have been taken away and questioned because of doodles that they were making on papers or in their notebooks in class. Is that right? I mean, I know I'm asking you to draw kind of a psychiatric conclusion here, but having studied Harris and Klebold and the panic that ensued at Columbine and, in fact, in school districts all across the country, did we get a little bit over the line, or were we right to view students in a new light?
We went way over the line, and that policy is typically referred to as zero tolerance. And, you know, it's implemented in different ways, but basically the gist is any kind of threat, any kind of, you know, somebody with a nail clipper that has a little, you know, file on it, people have been expelled for, any kind of situation, there's zero tolerance, you know, you suspend or expel or what have you. And that is really a huge mistake, you know, and I'll tell you why is, 81% of the school shooters told someone they were going to do it. The Secret Service studied every single school shooting from, I believe it was 1974 to 2000, you know, quite a lengthy period, and found some fascinating things, which, first of all, there is no profile of a school shooter, so we need to throw those ideas out that we think we know what they're like. They don't fit a consistent pattern. But one of the key things they did have in common is that most kids tell us. So it is really important to look for the warning signs, and when you see the warning signs, to investigate, to look into the kid. If it's serious enough, if it's a really specific threat and a high warning sign, then, you know, even search their house. But if you find out that it really was just a kid making a stupid joke, which kids make jokes, you really need to let him off and, you know, counsel him, talk to him about it, but not punish him. Because if you do punish him and have the zero tolerance, the message you're sending to kids is don't report your friends because they're going to get in terrible trouble. And we need those kids as our early warning system. So we need to let kids to give the message that if there's something that sounds like a joke, report it, we'll look into it, and if it's just a joke, we'll treat it, you know, not as a joke and not severely punish them.
The brand new book is Columbine, written by Dave Cullen, one of the reporters who was there on that April day nearly a decade ago at the deadliest high school shooting in U.S. history. When we come back, we'll talk about the role of, well, Dave and other members of the media in covering that story. And also, I'll ask him about Cassie Bernal, who was a high school girl who was shot in the head that day, and then evangelicals turned her into a martyr. We'll find out the truth behind that story when we come back here. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for Francine. Here on 84 WHAS and spending the hour talking with Dave Cullen, who's got a book out simply called Columbine. It is the definitive history of that horrible event. 10 years ago next Monday, April 20th, 1999. A story that immediately grabbed all of the news coverage in this country and held it for days afterwards. I think because so many of us know what it was like when we were in high school, and so many of us have kids in high school or elementary or other schools. Dave, you were there on that day reporting on it. Did you and other members of the media get parts of this story wrong from day one?
Yes, I'm afraid we got most of it wrong. There were a whole lot of myths. We talked about the trench coat mafia being ridiculous. The other big ones were that it was primarily intended as a school bombing instead of a school shooting. And we learned about the bombs just 2 days after, and it was reported everywhere. And the reason that story really never sticks and stuck in our memory, because when I do presentations now, almost no one there remembers that there were bombings. It just shocks them. But the reason is that's inconsistent with a bigger myth, which is what we do remember, which is that the killers were after jocks, and they were the main targets. And that's you know, just completely fantasy. When you think about what actually happened, is the bombs in the cafeteria were supposed to kill everyone initially, and how much more random can you get? I mean, how's that target any group when everyone is supposed to die?
Yep.
Then the next phase was that as the survivors ran out, the killers were out there to mow them down with automatic weapons. Again, that's as random as you can get. Now the bombs failed, and the killers realized that pretty quickly. So they met at the top of the stairs and started shooting at everyone that moved. Or Eric did, I should say. Dylan Harley fired it all while he was outside. He, once again, was the laggard and didn't really seem... It took him a while to get involved in this killing and didn't do a whole lot out there. But Eric literally turned in every single group that moved. He didn't hit most of them because it's hard to hit a moving target and a distant target. So most of those people got away. Some of them took target, but he shot at every single person. Then when they went into the library, it's true that they made a crack about all jocks standing up and you know, about jocks. They also made fun of a kid for being fat. They made fun of one kid there for having, you know, big ostentatious glasses. They made fun of every single group that you can imagine. One girl for praying, for believing in God. So any group that came up, they just heckled them, and they found out whatever, you know, looked at whatever was obvious about the kid, one for being black, and they made fun of that. So, you know, to take one comment out of the out of all that about the jocks and to construe this as being about them was just, looking back, it's really embarrassing that we did that.
A lot of media outlets and a lot of media personalities were looking for scapegoats here beyond just two middle-class white guys in a suburban Denver high school, and so they went after everything, people on every part of the political spectrum. There were people going after the gun culture. There were people going after video games, as if that is what had driven these two boys to commit this crime. Right?
Exactly. A lot of people took the agenda that they had going in, and, you know, within the first 5 minutes or the first 2 hours, had, you know, assumed, oh, there's another example of, you know, what I've been fighting about for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And paste this onto their agenda, and, you know, that's just not true. You just have to look at the facts of what actually did happen in this case.
You talk about the girl who was supposedly shot because she was praying or believed in God. Let's talk about her, because this was,
sure,
another one of the stories that came out that day. And evangelical groups across the country praised this girl, Cassie Bernal, was her name, and they kind of turned her into a martyr. What was the myth, and what was the truth?
Sure, the myth was that that she was praying, and that Eric Harris walked up to her and asked if she believed in God, and she said yes, and, you know, stood up to him and said yes, and then he shot her in the head, and that made her a modern-day martyr. God, people compared her, you know, to the first, from the first millennia, just the first few hundred years after Christ, and a modern-day martyr, and it became a gigantic story and a giant recruiting tool, unfortunately, around the world, actually. The truth was, actually, that there were two different girls in the cafeteria, in the library, one of them named Val Schnurr, and the other one was Cassie Bernal. And in Cassie's case, Eric walked up, slapped his hand on the top of the table that she was hiding under, said peekaboo, put the gun barrel of his gun underneath the lip of the table, and shot her in the head without her ever having the chance to respond. He may not have even seen her. He did that with a lot of people where he didn't care who was killing or even know. So that was obviously a tragic story of Cassie. Meanwhile, another place in the library, another girl was shot with a shotgun named Val Schnurr. She was crawling away, bleeding, And one of the killers walked up to her and asked her if she believed in God and had a bit of an exchange with her about why. And she said she was raised that way. You know, she explained herself. And then they got distracted by something else. There was all sorts of things going on. They were having a good time. Walked away, left her alone. She lived to tell. She's doing quite fine right now. She's a really, you know, nice young lady. And that's the girl who really spoke. And it's actually kind of an uplifting story. She professed her faith in God and lived to tell about it.
How long did it take the school community to pull itself back together after this horrible incident?
Well, you know, that's the thing about tragedies. There's really no one answer to that. You know, some kids were fine and on with their lives within 6 months or less, and they just put it behind them and never showed any signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. They're really the minority. Most kids, it took a lot longer. You know, some kids, it took 5 years. Some kids, it took 10 years. And if there's one thing that I can leave you with, one idea about tragedies like this, is to don't rush the healing. You know, and please let go of the word closure, which victims hear as shut up and get over it.
Yeah.
You know, why are you still complaining? But everyone goes at a different pace, and it varies dramatically from weeks to months to years, and you really just need to give people space to heal in their own time.
Dave, you've done a remarkable job in reporting this. I particularly like the information you included from the FBI agent. Is his name Dwayne Fusilier?
Fusilier, yeah, everyone, it's a Cajun, everybody gets that wrong, but yes, it's Fusilier, yeah, he was a very, very, he's one of the most fascinating characters in the book. People will enjoy.
Absolutely, and if you've listened to this entire hour and think now you know the whole story of Columbine, believe me, you don't, because
we've
Dave
scratched
has,
the surface, right?
Yeah, we've only scratched the surface, is right. Congratulations on all your reporting and on the book Columbine, which is just out now and I think destined to be not only a bestseller, but a real high watermark in reporting on horrible incidents like this. Thank you for your time and congratulations, Dave.
Thank you very much, Paul.